Welcome to the Sanity Interview. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and alongside my co-host, Rebecca Sugar, we talk to the people you want to hear from.
We're really happy today to have with us Josh Hammer, Senior Editor-at-Large at Newsweek. Thanks for coming, Josh. Josh is a syndicated columnist. He is the host of The Josh Hammer Show and America on Trial with Josh Hammer. He's a constitutional attorney, and his debut book, which we're here to talk about today, came out on March 18th. It's called Israel and Civilization, The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West.
Thank you guys for having me.
We're happy to. Josh, many of our listeners will know you as a really trenchant voice on legal and constitutional issues. You're an attorney who's written really perceptively, I think, about issues from presidential immunity to the role of the courts to constitutional design. So tell us a little bit about how you kind of went from, you know, thinking about the law to thinking about Israel. And was that a big transition, or was it something that's been on your mind for a while?
Look, I think anyone who knows me in any capacity knows that I've been very passionate about Israel and Jewish related issues for basically my entire adult life. When I was a third year law student back at the University of Chicago Law School, I was one of the student leaders leading a 40 student delegation to Israel. So I've been very involved in this issue for a very long time now. And, you know, more generally, I am a lawyer. I do write a lot about the law. I've had a few pieces of legal scholarship and have a co-authored piece coming out this spring in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy. So I still am involved in those circles for sure. I also write a weekly syndicated political column about just kind of the political topics of the day. So I have my hat in a lot of different arenas, you might say there. When it came time to choosing a topic for my debut book, because it did come time in my career where I've written all these columns and op-eds and these long form legal articles there. The one thing I hadn't done was write a book. So I was already planning to write a book. Roughly around the year 2023 is when I started brainstorming there. And initially, I actually was going to do something totally different. I was going to do, I don't want to belittle this, but kind of like your typical standard kind of, hey, I'm like a young conservative pundit. Here's my view of the world and here's where we should go in the future. That sort of conservative manifesto, you might say there. And then October 7th happened. And October 7th happened and the world reacted tragically the way that it did to October 7th. And it was really in response, not just to the pogrom, but to the world's reaction to October 7th. That to me, like so many other Jews, I think, so many other defenders of Western civilization, was a holy moly, I mean, jaw drops all the way to the floor moment. I mean, this is the reaction when a medieval Islamist death cult from the 7th century is doing a Nazi-like pogrom against Jews in the Jewish state there. It's time, frankly, for someone to defend the biblical inheritance that is Western civilization. It's time for someone to defend the Jewish people, defend the Jewish state, defend all of these things there. So I took it upon myself to attempt to do all of that. It's an ambitious task, but thank God, I think it came out pretty good, actually.
So Josh, you talked about being a conservative, and I pulled a quote that I thought was interesting from your book. I just want to read it. You write, "If being a conservative means anything whatsoever, then surely it means conserving the very Bible and the two great religions, Judaism and Christianity, which birthed, developed, and nourished that which we today call the West." So you're defining what it means to be a conservative, and you're sort of suggesting a definition of the West. So I wondered if you could just sort of dig a little bit more into that quote, what it means to be a conservative, to defend those values. And then I just thought, as a sort of way to move into the idea of the West, could you just define for us what you mean by the West? And under your definition, do you think that Europe, Western Europe, is still the West? Is this a book for America and the rest of the West, or is this a book for America?
I like that, the rest of the West.
The rest of the West.
Western civilization, the best and the rest, right? Yeah. So let me try to answer that question kind of in reverse order, actually, if I can. So, the subtitle of this book is The Fate of the Jewish Nation and the Destiny of the West. As AR noted, I am a lawyer, and as a lawyer, I like to define terms there. And it's true, we oftentimes do hear it's said kind of blithely sometimes that the West is at an inflection point or at a civilizational crossroads. I'm not downplaying that sentiment. I actually wholeheartedly agree with it. But to your important question, I do think that it is important to define what exactly it is that we're talking about. So the classical Straussian formulation from Leo Strauss is that Western civilization is something of a DNA strand-like double helix of sorts between reason and revelation, between Greco-Roman reason and the revelation of Jerusalem, really going back all the way to Mount Sinai. I don't dismiss that, but I do make a strong argument in the book's earlier chapters that I put a stronger thumb on the scale of revelation, actually, and Jerusalem, and really just the biblical tradition, quite literally going back to God's revelation to Moses and the Israelites at Mount Sinai. This is something that I think people from the English common law to the American founding throughout American history probably would have, frankly, readily agreed with. I mean, Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, when they were proposing what the national seal of the United States should be, they wanted it to be Moses leading the Israelites across the Red Sea there. They weren't kind of evoking Aristotelian imagery from the Socratic Academy or anything. They were actually putting a very strong thumb on the scale of the biblical narrative. The Liberty Bell in Philadelphia, on the outside, it has the verse inscribed from the book of Leviticus, "Thou shalt proclaim liberty throughout the land and to all the inhabitants thereof." They're not quoting the Nicomachean Ethics, again, of Aristotle or anything like that. So I genuinely do think that for the purposes of the West and what we have here today, I do put a stronger emphasis on revelation, on Jerusalem over reason and Athens. And one way, I think, to kind of assess this, and I think it's actually an important thought experiment for people watching this to engage in. Think about Thomas Jefferson writing the Declaration of Independence in 1776. He has this famous line that most Americans who are educated can probably recite by heart, where he says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and they are endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights." Well, ask yourself, I think, would it actually be self-evident to a goat herder who belongs to the Taliban in the mountains of Afghanistan? Probably not. The point is that for men like Thomas Jefferson and John Locke writing a century prior, it was self-evident within a certain context, within a certain intergenerational, cultural, and civilizational milieu. That milieu is the Bible. It is the Judeo-Christian tradition. In this particular case, is really kind of getting at Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, that God created man in his image there. That's where this is coming from. This notion that this is self-evident is coming from the divine image imperative of Genesis 1, 27, that is the shared inheritance of Jews and Christians alike there. So then kind of transitioning a little bit to the other part of your question there, what does it mean to be a conservative? Well, this is a loaded question, obviously. A lot of very important, and frankly, much smarter people than me have thought and wrote about this at great length over the centuries. But it seems to me that if a conservative means anything whatsoever, it means conserving this intergenerational chain of transmission that has defined who we are and our traditions and our values and our way of life and trying to pass it on to the next generation. I actually quote Pirkei Avot. I quote a little Talmud in this book, and Pirkei Avot chapter 1, verse 1 literally begins by describing the intergenerational transmission of the oral Torah, of the word of God from Moses to Joshua to the elders to the prophets and so forth there. So this notion of the importance of inheriting a tradition and passing it on to the next generation is a very halakhic Jewish concept, but I think it's also kind of the classic Burkean formulation of what it means to be a conservative in the first place, which is kind of interesting on a personal note, because personally, as I talk about in this book, Israel and Civilization, I actually came to my religious beliefs almost through my politics, and somewhat of a reverse cause of order, as many Americans who come to their political conclusions through their religion there. I kind of did it in reverse order, actually. So to me, this logical consistency between Judaism and Burkean conservatism, we might call it, is actually appealing and frankly kind of has been borne out by my very own personal life.
So would you say that your project here is a kind of act of reminding or an act of recovery, right? You've quoted these thinkers from the 18th century, and I spoiler alert, you think that something has gone awry, right? We've sort of somehow lost touch with some of that. But I was struck that, you know, the word America doesn't apply in your title, right? I mean, your argument is pitched broader. So where would you say sort of the West writ large, to jump off Rebecca's question, has it forgotten these examples? Has it taken on new teachers and new values that have delivered it to a very different place? Or what's your account of sort of where we started and where we are now?
Yeah, I think it's been a very slow, unfortunate atrophy, I guess, for lack of a better word, a slow kind of intellectual atrophy, and just a forgetfulness, frankly, of the very values and principles and precepts that we oftentimes just truly take for granted. So, I mean, something as basic and prosaic as the golden rule. So I actually start one of my chapters in the book by talking about the golden rule. The golden rule, as I learned it in public school and kindergarten, was taught to me as you treat others as you would like to be treated there. Now, because it was public school, I was not taught that this is really actually derived from the book of Leviticus, chapter 19, you shall treat a stranger as your fellow. And I attempt really to kind of painstakingly remind many of us, I already alluded to Genesis 1:27 and the divine image imperative. I'm really trying to remind my fellow Americans, my fellow Westerners, that so much of what we do on a day-to-day basis, from our basic norms to our law, to our political and constitutional order, all of it really does get back to the Bible. And frankly, in many ways, to the Hebrew Bible as well. Just to give one particular example, you know, AR, you notice, are you noted earlier, my commentary when it comes to legal issues and the lawfare against President Trump there. So to give just one very concrete example, we've heard this constant refrain in recent years from Donald Trump's opponents, how no one is above the law. That's kind of one of their main go-to lines. I obviously agree with that. The question is what the law is. But more important, you know, where do they think this concept is coming from, that no man is above the law there? It's actually literally from the book of Deuteronomy, this notion that the monarch in that case shall not be above the law. In fact, the early English common law thinkers, when they put that in the common law, were making direct reference to the book of Deuteronomy. So there's so many examples here that our modern way of thinking is just shaped by the Bible. But there are forces all around us who I think have either by accident or just deliberately, one or the other, have either forsaken or just literally just forgotten about all that we today stand for. So, I mean, take a few examples. I mean, one would be the DEI woke neo-Marxist left. They stand for this neo-Marxist dichotomy of oppressor versus oppressed classes there. That's their view of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. That's their view of a lot of things happening domestic here in America when it comes to Black Lives Matter and the post-October 7th stuff. I mean, but this whole worldview of arbitrarily dividing Americans into two dueling classes of oppressed versus oppressor there is fundamentally premised on a rejection of Genesis 1:27, on a rejection of genuine, divinely inspired or divinely given moral human equal worth and equal dignity among all the people there. So too, we see very troubling indications in certain pockets of the right. So I talk about these troubling pockets of the right there, even though I am myself a man of the right. You have the rise of this modern nihilist neo-Nietzschean segment of the right, encapsulated, we might say, by the Tate brothers, Andrew and Tristan Tate there, you know, with all their talk about exalting brute human strength, the classic pagan ideal, and this notion of a man being manly by spreading his seed as far and wide as he can. These are anti-biblical ideals. This is not the biblical way of thinking at all. And then probably even more pernicious, you have the rise of certain people who call themselves Christians and they like to tweet out things like Christ is King. And they seem to be motivated by this deeply cynical and massively insidious desire to drive a wedge, a chasm between Jews and Christians, people like Candace Owens, Tucker Carlson, and so forth there. So that's one of my core audiences for this book as well, is to remind these younger Christians who I think might otherwise be tempted to go down a particularly dark path, that when you forsake the Jewish people and by extension the Jewish state historically, very, very, very bad things have happened. A society that turns on the Jews historically does not end well. And furthermore, it's not a particularly shocking revelation, but I think it was important just as a useful reminder to young Christians here who might be tempted to go there. Where do you think Christianity comes from? Well, it obviously is based, I mean, there's a New Testament, of course, but it really, I mean, it has the Hebrew Bible as a massive, massive component of it. We really do share our biblical inheritance.
So Bible sales in America are up. The Bible seems to be back, and so that must make you happy. And at the same time, it's not clear to me that American Jewry, the people of the book, are particularly, I don't know, trending in the same direction in terms of affiliation, maybe even, and we're not speaking here, I don't think your book is speaking about, maybe it is, about religion per se. We're talking about knowledge and understanding of the fundamental texts that underpin the foundations of this country and also our particular traditions. And you could read them, you know, in a religious context or not a religious context, but just that familiarity. It's not clear to me that most American Jews are deeply proficient in the Bible. What then is your prescription for American Jewry if they are concerned about the future of American Jewry in America and also the future of Israel. And if they are disconnected from the book, which you say is the foundation of everything, if these are their concerns, what is your prescription for that large segment of the American Jewish population?
Well, you know, thankfully, I have a whole chapter answering this question. So the second last chapter of the book, one of my favorite chapters of the book actually is called The Maccabean Imperative. It's my call to my fellow American Jews to be modern day Maccabees. It's a little personal. I mean, my last name is Hammer, so my Hebrew name is actually Maccabee because Judah the Maccabees, a nickname was Judah the Hammer back in the day. So it's kind of it's a bit of a play on that. I proposed to my then girlfriend, now wife, on the third night of Hanukkah overlooking the Kotel, the Western Wall in Jerusalem. So the whole Maccabean Hanukkah story is kind of ingrained in me there. But the point of this chapter, you know, I am Baal Teshuva. I'm someone who grew up very secular, very, very assimilated. I literally did not go to my first Shabbat dinner. I don't think I knew what Shabbat was until probably studying for my bar mitzvah at the earliest. I mean, maybe in my teenage years after that. I mean, I almost didn't even have a bar mitzvah. I grew up about as assimilated as it gets for American Jewry there. I've changed quite a bit since then there. And, you know, part of this chapter is kind of just trying to speak to my fellow more religiously or institutionally disaffected Jews and kind of just trying to set an example, honestly, just saying, you know, I've done this, kind of here is what I did here. You can just dive in too. And at a certain point, if you care about the Jewish community, which every Jew obviously should, if you care about the Jewish people, I'm Israel, call Israel, if you care about Eretz Israel, the state of Israel, you really should care about all these things. You have to think about what you actually can do to make the greatest impact there. And, you know, unfortunately, this is not a particularly novel observation, but a lot of people, I think, have a distorted view of what does the most good there. So, for example, you know, if you go to Reform Judaism's RAC, their Religious Action Center, they have a call to action there for their politically active congregants. Most of those items there, without having checked it recently, I still feel pretty confident saying most of those items are not necessarily narrowly targeted at the health, safety, prosperity, security, and flourishing of the Jewish people there. So, you know, regardless of what your level of religious knowledge or biblical knowledge was, I started personally basically at zero there. The point is that you can just take it upon yourself to kind of just dive in there. So I really do explicitly say in the chapter, you know, if you're a young guy who's never put on a pair of tefillin, go do that. Like I actually go out and do that. Give it a shot. You know, try going to actual synagogue on Shabbat here in the weekly parsha there. You might actually really be surprised. You might actually enjoy it there. When it comes to the state of Israel there, never, ever, ever shy away from supporting the state of Israel there. Another thing that I argue in the book is that when it comes to the specific issue of Israel and the conflict with the Palestinian Arabs there, so often the Zionist pro-Israel side default to these very weak-kneed procedural arguments where they say, oh, we just want peace. We just want two states there. These arguments are total losers because you're basically begging for mercy and forgiveness against a force that's accusing you of what they call the Nakba and occupation, all this very morally charged language, this heavily morally infused argumentation. Now, it happens to be immoral, but they're making an oral argument there. So similarly, when it comes to the specific issue of Israel and the conflict with the Palestinian Arabs there, make an overt moral argument. Talk about the Bible. Talk about archaeology. Talk about the fact that the Jewish people, the original people of the book, absolutely do deserve nothing less than their own right to self-determination in their own ancestral homeland there. So, you know, it's all in there, but
I think what I hear you saying is that, right, point number one for Jews and Christians is read the Bible. Wouldn't that be the place to start? If I were reading this book, that's what my big takeaway would be.
There's a lot of Bible quote in this book. I quote scripture a lot in this book, both Torah and Oral Torah and the Talmud. So for sure, I mean, the Jewish people's greatest gift to the world, in my opinion, is the Bible. I mean, the original people of the book, they are the original recipients of God's word at Mount Sinai. The Jewish people brought monotheism to the world. That is a very, very, very big deal. And if there is one thing that I would like to encourage Jews to think more about, yeah, it probably would be that, as opposed to kind of these cultural totems like, you know, Bagel and Lox and Seinfeld and all this modern stuff.
Right. to kind of zoom into the present, right? The subtitle of your book is The Fate of the Jewish Nation, The Destiny of the West. So, you know, Israel's now been at war for, more than a year and a half. We've seen what's happened, you know, on college campuses, but also in Europe and elsewhere. So what's the state of play? I mean, what is the fate of the Jewish nation? What's the destiny of the West? Where are these trajectories going? In a sort of real kind of tachless, sense as we wake up, this morning in late March.
Yeah, so it's a kinetic situation, obviously, and this ceasefire has now ended, and the IDF tanks are rolling back in there. I think it's very clear. I think that Israel has no choice whatsoever but to meaningfully finish the job in Gaza. I understand that's easier said than done. The issue for Israel is that they announced very clearly at the onset of this war, after October 7th, that there were two unambiguous military goals for this particular conflict. One was the retrieval of all the hostages. Two was the eradication of Hamas as a political and military institution. They've made tremendous progress on the hostage front. Obviously, there are roughly 24 or 25 alive and other tragically deceased bodies, we feel. So they've made great progress on that front. But Hamas is still in power. We saw that during these horrible transfers of the hostages and the coffins, the terrible scenes of the Bibas family. So we see that Hamas has basically come out of their sewers. They've come out of the tunnels and they're still in power. And the problem is that the lingua franca, the language of the Arab world, of the proverbial Arab street, is basically that it all comes down to strength. There is nothing more important than projecting strength and demonstrating strength when it comes to deterring your threats in that particular part of the world. So when you announce a goal of eradicating Hamas and then you fail to achieve it, you will seriously, seriously undermine your own self-standing and your own future deterrence. In this particular case, I think Prime Minister Netanyahu also severely risks disappointing his close friend, President Trump. President Trump has given Benjamin Netanyahu the greenest green light he ever could have hoped for. He's used very fiery rhetoric, such as they will pay hell for not returning the hostages, his plan in Gaza. I mean, we're obviously still waiting on details, but his plan is very aggressive, I guess, would be one way of describing it for Gaza there. So Netanyahu has about the greenest green light he could ever hope for there. He has to actually go in and finish his job there.
He's been too timid.
I do, but I don't necessarily blame him, because a lot of it was during the Biden administration when who knows exactly what was going on behind the scenes there. That's a very difficult situation to be in, where a very hostile administration is threatening to undermine you everywhere, from arms shipments to the United Nations, when it comes to if you don't execute this war in exactly the right way. But overall, yeah, I definitely do think that the IDF has actually been too timid thus far.
I want to talk about the response on campuses here in America and sort of ask you to talk about the legal line that Ari and I talk about sometimes on this show, when the Jewish community organizes to respond to some of the events that happen on some of these campuses. Sometimes I think they come up against a line that's not so defined, that sort of relates to some of what you're talking about in your book about American Jews have to be very have to defend American civil liberties in order to defend themselves as Jews and in order to defend Israel appropriately. But they also have to defend themselves and Israel. And sometimes those two missions can come up against this funny line. And I just wonder where you draw that. Do you sign petitions that call for students on campus not to be able to say from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free? Is that an appropriate constitutional line for you? Where do you see that playing itself out in the fight to defend Israel and Jews on campus? And what would be your prescription for that if you were thinking, as your book does, about how to satisfy both the American and the Jewish part of the American Jewish identity?
Yeah, so I actually did a wonderful 2-on-2 debate on this very question at Harvard last April. It was hosted by ISI, the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. So we were literally debating this exact question. What are the legal and moral parameters of speech on campus, especially in context of October 7th? My first way to answer this question is that the First Amendment, I think it's important to remind a lot of people, really does not mean what a lot of people think it means. I think a lot of people have a certain conception of the First Amendment that it is absolutist, that it protects literally everything that can possibly come out of someone's mouth, no matter what the context is. That's simply not the case. I mean, you can go back and look at the American founding. You can go back and look at the fact that the English common law of defamation was inherited at the time of the founding there. There were prosecutions in New York State in well into the 19th century for blasphemy, for actually blaspheming Jesus Christ, actually, in the New York State courts at the particular time. Their pornography certainly would never in a million years have been considered First Amendment protected there. So there actually are real limits here when it comes to the First Amendment properly construed there. When it comes to the particular example you gave, which is a very good one, this chant of from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free there, I do think it's important to talk about what they're actually saying. What are they actually saying there? Well, they're actually calling for the ethnic cleansing, frankly, it seems to me like the genocide of the Jewish people there. It is absolutely a defiant assertion of so-called anti-Zionism. So then that kind of leads us to the next logical inquiry, if we're kind of doing this in a bit of a syllogism exercise. Is anti-Zionism anti-Semitism? I say yes. The IRA definition also says yes. So does Donald Trump. His 2019 executive order, when it came to defining Title VI for students on campus, explicitly adopted the IRA definition and said that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism for protection of Jewish students on campus there. So that kind of all brings us back there. Yes, I do think that it would not be permissible to actually shout from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free, on university campus here. That is absolutely the kind of thing that under current First Amendment and Title VI law and our tradition ought to be proscribed and curtailed there. I'm not necessarily saying that there's a specific remedy in mind there. The remedy can depend on the situation, whether that comes from internally at the Office of Civil Rights on a given university administration bureaucracy or whatever, or whether it comes from the federal government, the DOJ, Department of Education there. But that is the sort of conduct that ought to be curtailed. I mean, I think goes without saying that if that ought to be curtailed, then a lot more of this other nonsense. I mean, keeping Jewish students off the quad at UCLA, all of this obviously is deeply troubling and typically not in our legal tradition.
Would you be concerned under that framing that those in a different administration, if Zionism were deemed to be racism or violence, as some people claim it is,
that settler colonialism or this kind
right
of thing.
that Jewish students would be subject to the same restriction on their speech that you just said was permissible or, you know, appropriate in the other direction? I mean, that's the line I'm sort of talking about, trying to get you to parse out.
Look, I mean, I think it's always fair and interesting to kind of ask kind of like, what if the shoe were on the other foot there? I don't think that is a particularly plausible reality, frankly, for the next 15, 20, 30 years or so. Obviously, that's the notion that Zionism as itself amounts to genocidal violence is a very minority opinion there. I mean, I suppose if Rashida Tlaib were to become president of the United States, maybe she could try to drive this interpretation of Title VI down university campuses' throats there. But, you know, again, we get back to actual civil rights protection here. I mean, the Civil Rights Act is a legitimate thing, and it applies to every university that takes every single penny of taxpayer dollars. Not every university does that, by the way. Hillsdale College, they are exempt from things like this because they don't actually take any federal funding. But if you take federal funding, then you have to play by the rules of the road there. So then the relevant legal question is, what does the Civil Rights Act of 1964 actually say? And as the case may be, it protects university students against things from like discrimination on the basis of race, national origin, and indeed religion. So if it's protecting the basis of religion, the relevant question is anti-Semitism anti-Zionism? So it's kind of just a logical inquiry there. I genuinely just think that is actually the logically coherent answer there. And I try to kind of just answer that question without being too particularly concerned about hypothetical consequentialism, you know, 20, 30 years from now.
Let me ask you one more question, Josh, and we'll let you go. You know, I think most people and supportive of Israel also can be a little downbeat these days. I mean, it's been a grueling war. By all accounts, anti-Semitism has spiked. There's a sense maybe the longer this goes on, the more the situation deteriorates for Jews. You know, they look for where is the West? They look at Paris, they look at London, they look at New York, and they're often disappointed. So are you an optimist on this score? Where do you think the fate and the destiny, respectively, of the Jewish state and the West lie?
I think that Israel is actually in great shape. I am a total white pill optimist when it comes to the particular state of Israel. Israel has a lot of things that most Western countries currently do not have. They have a tremendously high birth rate. Contrary to popular perception, this is not just among the Haredim, the so-called ultra-Orthodox. Even secular Israelis actually are well above two children per child-bearing woman there. They have a birth rate overall. The whole country is almost double that of the United States. It completely exceeds, I think, literally every single European country there. So that is a very positive indication. Israelis more generally have a very strong sense of national pride. One thing that I think is actually worth noting here, and I opined quite heavily back in 2023 during the judicial reform debates, which seemed like they're coming back again there. And I was a supporter, in short, of the reform movement. But I noted at that time, and I think it's worth emphasizing now, that even the opponents of the judicial reform, they're the people at Haaretz and so forth there that think that Bibi Netanyahu is a fascist and a dictator. You know, when they're wrong on that, obviously. But when they're out there in the streets and they're protesting, they still fly the Israeli flag. To me, that's actually very notable. Contrast that here in America with the behavior of folks on the American left when they're out there, you know, protesting for Black Lives Matter and causes like that there. They're not necessarily waving the American flag, are they? I mean, they're more likely to fly the Palestinian flag or maybe even to be burning the American flag, things like that there. So that to me is a sign of a country that, despite its intense political disagreements internally, has a strong, cohesive, coherent sense of nationhood and peoplehood. So for these reasons, I'm actually pretty optimistic about the state of Israel. Right now, Israel also, they only have one existential enemy. That's Iran. Turkey could become that. Turkey has potential to become that, especially given Erdogan's current ordeals in Damascus, which are increasingly getting quite hairy and frankly horrible. But as of now, the Iranian regime is also Israel's only truly existential threat. That is a historically good place for Israel to be in, where they actually only have one existential threat. As far as the future of America, of the West, that's obviously a more complicated question here. But to kind of bring this conversation full circle, I guess I will say this. If there is one thing that I can offer that is as close to a panacea as I can possibly think of, your one-stop shop to try to make America great again earnestly, not just as a kind of a political catchphrase or anything there, I have long thought that just getting more Christians in Bible-believing churches and more Jews in Torah-observant synagogues there, that really, really, really would genuinely go such a long way, I think, to solving virtually all of our woes here when it comes to dating, when it comes to marriage, when it comes to child-rearing, when it comes to our loneliness, despondency epidemic, God forbid, increasing rates of suicide, drug overdose. I really do root ultimately almost all of these problems in declining religiosity and declining attendance in house of worship itself.
With that, Rabbi Hammer, I think, yeah, I just promoted you to rabbi. We're going to thank you very much.
I do not deserve that, but
for being here. And we recommend that everyone run out and buy Israel and Civilization and find out more about what you have to say about all these issues. Thank you for sharing your time with us.
Bye. Thank you guys very much. Thank you.